Hello, and welcome back to The Great Game, an Australian Mega Games podcast. I'm Patrick.
And I'm Jack.
And this is our lost episode that we recorded over 18 months ago in May 2021, during the dark times. This is our interview sit down with Theo, Nelly and Tristan from Melbourne Mega Games about It Belongs in a Museum, which is a game that they ran during that time back in 2021. So, It Belongs in a Museum is a bit of a mega game inspired by Treasure Hunters and Indiana Jones style adventures. And it sounds like from this discussion, they had a lot of fun running it and playing it. But before we jump into that, I am going to hand over to Jack in true form to give us a quick update on what's happening in the mega game world.
Absolutely. So Melbourne Mega Games are processing signups now for Crisis in Elysium, their next game. It's a game about 22nd century Mars, politics, backstabbing, gunfights on Martian city streets, all that kind of good stuff. So definitely highly recommend if you can get down to Melbourne for the dates. I believe it will be kicking off next month. Highly recommend checking it out, which you can easily do on their Facebook. Apart from that, Mega Game Assembly have been continuing on keeping the fire alive for Mega Games, which has been awesome. Tons of blog posts and the full Mega Game calendar of Mega Games happening across the globe are live on that website. So definitely recommend checking out megagameassembly.com if you're looking for more great Mega Game content.
Excellent. And we will, as always, have links to those in the show notes when we do publish. So I suppose before we jump into the episode, it obviously has been a long time. Jack, we've both been busy with a lot of other things, not least the crazy times that we've just been living through. What's the future look like now that we're finally getting this episode out?
Oh, boy. Well, we're both extremely keen to get into more stuff in the new year. Ultimately, it's just been pretty hard to juggle everything with the events of the world. but we are both very keen to get back into it as much as we can.
Absolutely. So with that non-committal, I say we jump right in, have a listen to this conversation. Keep in mind that it was 18 months ago, May 2021, but it was a really good chat with the gang down south, and hope you enjoy. Right, and thank you all for joining us today. We're talking about It Belongs in a Museum, mega game that the Melbourne Mega Games ran earlier this year, twice in a row down in Melbourne. So with me today, with me and Jack today, we've got Tristan, Nelly, and Theo. Did you guys just want to quickly introduce yourselves and let us know where you're from in the mega game world?
Yeah, hi. So I'm Tristan. I'm sort of one half of Melbourne Mega Games. So I've been helping run Mega Games in Melbourne, Australia since like 2018 now, 2017 kind of really, if we include the game that was before Melbourne Mega Games itself, which was God Emperor. Mm. Been around a bit, played a little bit, run a few games, even had Pat down to run a game, and Nelly's been on the show before. A bit of experience in making games.
Yeah, so God Emperor was the first game that I played as a mega game, and then Tristan and I teamed up after that because we decided that we wanted more mega games in Melbourne than we were able to get from just going to Pulps. So yeah, we made Melbourne Mega Games happen. And we started with Watch the Skies, which I spoke to you guys about a while ago. Then obviously For the Crown, which I missed because I was on exchange. And now It Belongs in the Museum, which was awesome. And I've also started recently getting into designing games, but it'll probably be a while before we see anything with my name on it.
Awesome.
Oh, I guess the other important thing is that I do a lot of the like visual design for our games when we're doing unfinished works or new works.
Yeah. And we'll have links in the show notes to your online presence for you guys, Melbourne Mega Games, where you can see a lot of Nelly's past design work. And Theo?
So my experience of Mega Games was Tristan went, hey, this looks cool, dragged me and a couple other friends down to Geelong. Was that 2016 for Pulp running their second Watch the Skies?
It was, yeah.
And so we started together and now they dragged me in as a control member to help run Melbourne Mega Games. And I generally get stuck on the war map because of my background in Warhammer and other war
it's
games.
It's good. Anyone who runs and designs Mega Games has at least one person that they just drag around to make two things in those games. Yeah. Totally, I can.
Yeah, sure. Just one. We'll go with just one person.
At least one.
Definitely not a team of seven.
Yeah, it's a long-suffering cadre of our friends, I think, definitely. At this point.
So tell us about It Belongs in a Museum. What's the game about? Where does it come from? And what made you want to run it?
So Nelly discovered it. So Nelly, how did you actually find the game?
I think I just saw it on Facebook or maybe on the Mega Game Assembly's calendar. And I saw it, and because I come from a cultural heritage museum studies like academic background, I saw the word museum and like all the dopamine spots in my brain lit up. And I was like, okay, this is cool. So I looked into it and it seemed right up my alley in just in terms of general interest. So, yeah, I brought that back to Tristan and we reached out to Jake and Rick and they were really excited that we had found their game and thought that it was something really cool that we wanted to run. So that was a nice experience.
Awesome. So give us a summary for people who haven't seen the Mega Game before of what the game is about.
Okay. So it's basically Indiana Jones, the Mega Game. So teams predominantly play as teams of explorers. So you have your archaeologist, your antiquarian, and your researcher. And they all have different roles within the game, but the general gist of it is you are hunting for artifacts, and then the other teams are museum teams, and they are trying to collect artifacts to fill out their museum and to put on wonderful exhibitions. And some of the artifacts have some interesting qualities that lead to some very narrative and fun plot outcomes.
I will just add to that that Nelly mentioned a couple of names before. So It Belongs in a Museum was originally run in the United Kingdom for True North Mega Games. It was created and designed by three people over there, Jake Smithson, Ricardo, I'm going to say this name wrong, Viglianisi, I think, and Danielle McAloon. So we mostly spoke with Jake and Ricardo, the first two, but they were very helpful in helping us move the game down under and actually get our hands across it and understand it.
Oh, yeah, I have so much gratitude for those guys. And, you know, we'll talk to them later. But, yeah, huge thanks to them for everything they've done for us and for the game.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jack and I were just, prior to this, we're having a look at some of the information posted out about the game that when it was run over there. And, yeah, we're really keen to have a chat to them as well about the original design process and how it all came to be. You mentioned that the players are kind of split up in this game into little teams and they're all kind of doing the same thing. How many players were involved and, like, so how many of those teams were there? And are we able to just delve a little bit into what that looked like? What were players doing on the day?
Yeah, I can talk to that. So the first game, so this is actually interesting. So when we got the game to begin with, it's a game that had seven explorer teams. So seven teams of three explorers, so it's 21 explorers, and then four teams of two for the museums. So the game in total is actually quite a small mega game in its 29 players. But it's a quite control-heavy mega game. We'll talk a little bit more about why that is later, but yeah, in control terms, it was when we first spoke to Jake and Rick, they said, yeah, it's only 29, 30, you know, 30 players, but it's also 12 control. Ooh. And we sat there and went, 12 control? That's like one control for every three players, which is a ridiculous ratio. And the reason for that is basically the core mechanic and the core gameplay loop in It Belongs to the Museum is running expeditions and going on an expedition to retrieve an artifact. So you get basically players get like clues as to where an artifact may be, and then if they decide to go after that artifact, there's some resources and economy built into that into going on an expedition. But they get some gear, they assemble a team, and then they go on this expedition, usually with the sponsorship of a museum. And then on this actual expedition, a series of dice checks is basically made, but also it's a narrative expedition. So it's like a mini D&D adventure in that one expedition control will sit down and run the sort of five little steps that come in an expedition, and you'll actually role play through them, right? So it can be as simple as if a team is not super role play, they can sit down and just say, okay, yep, we're just going to roll the statistics that are listed in the mechanics of the game. So every character has four different attributes: athletics, luck, ingenuity, and knowledge. And basically, you've got different dice that go along with those, and there's a dice system basically based on D6s, custom D6s, and you can make checks, right? If your team's not interested in role-playing, they can just make checks based on the rules they've got in a very board game style. But there's also a very strong component of the game is encouraging narrative role-playing, basically. How can you creatively solve this problem, right? You get given a short description of the problem, and then you actively are encouraged to play into that and play around that. And I'm sure we can talk about some really interesting examples of that throughout the game. But one of the pieces of equipment that people were able to buy throughout both games is orphans. And whenever there are orphans thrown into narrative role-playing situations, it's a time.
All right. I think that's going to be something we'll have to dig into a bit later. So what were the...
Oh, I will just add with the teams. So when we got the game, it was seven teams.
Right.
We had so much interest in when we originally scheduled the game in 2020 in March that we decided to add an eighth team. So that was awesome. That worked really well. We took inspiration from Matthew Riley's Seven Ancient Wonders series.
Ah, yeah,
and so nice. We added a team based on Jack West and his team. And then... that was fine. We ran game one. In between game one and game two, we encountered a potential player who was really, really keen to play. And so Tristan and I just kind of said, oh, fuck it, we'll make a ninth team. And so we added a ninth team in between the two runs of the game. And I honestly think that more teams worked better for the expeditions and for some of the plot lines. So it was a last-minute addition, but it, I thought, worked phenomenally.
We also, and this is a key change we'll talk about later as well, is we actually added a press team. So originally the press were control in the first, in the British run of the game. We added them as players, and that basically boosted, you know, added two players to the game, and that really boosted and changed the dynamic of the game as well.
Right. Okay. And I'm assuming that the expeditions were mostly, those little role play / expedition sessions were mostly the explorer teams. What were the museum teams doing, or did they play into the expeditions too?
Well, Theo was on a museum team, and Theo, you can probably answer this.
Yeah, so the museum teams were kind of split. You had one person who would go and do the research mini games.
Mm-hmm.
And then a second person would sort of, you know, schmooze and sell.
Mm.
But both of you, both or one of you could go with explorer teams on the expeditions if you wanted to. And you could, you know, convince them to take you with them, which they generally let you do because more people generally made them easier.
Right.
So for all that the museum teams had less incentive to go on expeditions, there was still a lot of them going on the expeditions too.
Right, okay. And this is probably a good time to point out that, Theo, you did play in one of the games, and Tristan, yeah, you also played in one of the games.
Yes.
And a little bit later on, probably we're going to be transitioning to a point where we start talking about a bit more narrative detail, which will probably be, spoilers beyond this point. So forgive us if we try and keep things a little bit vague from here up until that point. My only other question about the teams was, how did they interact? It sounds like the explorers would shoot off and do their little expeditions and then come back, interact with the museums, do a deal or something. How did those three types of teams all interact?
So on the whole, there was generally, it was very much a lot of the museums were getting the quests to then, you know, find explorers to go and do them. So explorers then had to go and, you know, look for museums who were willing to give them a quest and generally fund going on that quest.
Hmm.
So that was sort of your main point of interaction, was giving and receiving quests and money for them, and the other interaction was sort of, you know, we've acquired this artifact. Would you be interested in buying it?
Right.
And that key kind of interaction is the dynamic is central to the game, right? In that museums are people poor, but asset rich. They have lots of money. They have lots of things they want and not enough people to do it with. But there's lots of explorers teams out there, right? In our run of the game, the explorers outnumber the museums 2-1. So museums are managing, you know, okay, we've got these people doing this quest, we've got these people doing this quest, and who's going where, and what am I doing, and how are we, they've got that time kind of pressure on them, whilst explorers are poor and hungry and fighting over these scraps, and they've also got, and this is a key part to the game, and we'll probably talk about it much more depth in the spoiler section later on, is every player has motivations, every player has allies and enemies, so there's individual character briefings, as well as global team briefings as well, and so it's a very, content forward game in that regard.
And something really interesting with the team interactions as well was that in game one there was a lot of collaboration and there was a lot of teaming up to go on expeditions, working together. There wasn't as much play into the adversary and enemy side of the character briefings. Game two, however, involved a lot more just like go it alone, don't try and get someone to work with you. There was a lot more explorer teams working with museums rather than explorer teams working with explorer teams. It's a really interesting dynamic. Yeah. I think mostly a difference in player attitude, but we also slightly tweaked the character briefings in between the two games, so that might have had something to do with it as well. But yeah, I thought that was interesting.
I think another element was game one had a lot of people who are coming to our mega games a lot. And so there was, you know, pre-existing relationships, whereas game two was largely people who have never mega gamed before.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And so they didn't have those pre-existing relationships.
Yeah, right. Okay. And the last thing I'll ask there, it sounds like we'll get a bit more detail later on, but with those explorer teams, when they were adversarial, were their mechanics built for that? Is that part of the game, or was it more of a role-play thing, scheming and politicking?
So game two, I was playing as espionage control. So there is a full set of espionage mechanics, and game two, the explorer teams loved sending assassins and thugs and international police after each other. My favorite example is that the idealists, who are sort of Indiana Jones and his team, were very set on we're sending assassins after our rivals.
That's very idealistic.
Yes.
Very nice.
The other mechanic is that you can basically snipe artifacts. And I think that this only happened once over the two runs in game two, where with appropriate planning and investment in espionage, you can show up to the end of another team's expedition and do what they call a Belloc from the first Indiana Jones movie, and just show up and take the golden idol from the other team after they've come out of the expedition, run down and exhausted, and they basically can't resist because, you know, they've just fought their way through this complex and exhausting expedition, and you've shown up fresh, having done your research and
waiting for them at the mouth with guns pointed at their faces, being like, thank you for your hard effort, we'll take it from here.
Awesome.
Pretty much.
There was actually a second time I realized, Nelly, that happened, but it didn't happen in the same way. It happened when one player became one. So when we added the press, we gave them the ability to also go on expeditions themselves as players themselves, giving you a reason to take the press along with you because they're helpful. And also then they could report on the stories. But it so happened in the second game that we had a press player go on an expedition and be the only player to survive that entire expedition. And so they were quite literally the last person standing. And so they're standing there at the end. The whole rest of the expedition got knocked out in the very first of five steps. And so this player, who's actually a controller, a good friend of ours, Chris, he managed to escape with this artifact at the end. He was sort of standing around going, well, what do I do now? Everyone else is unconscious in hospital.
Awesome.
That was a lot of fun.
Awesome. So talking about some of the changes you made, we've talked about the changes to teams and the extra players and things like that. Are there any other changes that you made to the original source material?
Before game one, we got... It was interesting. The state of the game as we received it was probably not runnable. We could have taken it the next day, printed out the stuff that Jake and Rick gave us and done a job of it, but it wouldn't have been at the standard that we as Melbourne Mega Games really pride ourselves on. And so in the sort of the year and a half lead in time. We and especially Nelly put in a lot of effort to redoing a lot of the work, not just in design work and actually redesigning the game or making sure that it was well explained and structured in the rules, but also then physically formatting that, presenting it and structuring it in a way that made it deliverable to players. And so from a design point of view, I think the main things that we added were the extra team. We revamped the press and added them in as players. What else am I missing? I think that's pretty much it, though.
Renown. So in between the two games, some of the feedback we got from game one is that there were a lot of player briefings that said you must acquire renown, you know, make yourself really famous as an explorer. And that didn't really come out in the roleplay. So between the games, we just added an extra currency to the game. So there's currency that is currency, there's espionage tokens, and there's research tokens. And so we added renown tokens. And I think we said that you could use them in place of any like check or purchase that required the other two tokens, and that you could use them for, like the press could give them out, and you could use them at the Explorers Club, which was an event every three rounds where the archaeologist gathered and boasted about their exploits.
Right, nice.
In the previous
three
rounds.
So it was like a wild currency, basically? Like it could be used for anything?
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of. And that landed really well, worked really well. It got used. It was a small change, but I think it had a really positive impact on the game. So that's the only other thing I can think of.
Yeah, between the two games, we kind of added in a few little tweaks like that, in that we also gave museums a few more artifacts to start with. We made some big changes structurally behind the scenes in how we organized expeditions. And we'll talk about this a little bit more once we get into spoiler territory, but there are some... Basically, there's a ton of pre-authored content in the game in terms of all these expeditions that you go on. There's over 90 expeditions in the game.
Wow.
And... yeah, structuring those and knowing which ones to give out at the right time was the hardest and worst part of the first game. And so we revamped that entirely for the second game.
Right, right. And could I just ask on the follow-up, your comments about having to do some design work and, you know, get it up to your standards. Was that just sort of, were the guys in the UK not really ready to package up this product and hand it over, or were they themselves still doing design work? Was it just the, you know, the components, or what required, what prompted you guys to think we need to do a bit of work on this?
So it was primarily the components. I think you hit on it when you said they weren't fully prepared to package it up, but we wanted it. So I was kind of, we did a deal where we paid slightly less than what they originally asked for the license fee in exchange for designing this visual content for the game that they'll get back. Yeah, I think Tristan and I will have a meeting and package up what we have done to send back to them in some kind of arrangement.
Nice.
But yeah, we got the files in Visio form. So I took all of the components and Tristan did a lot of work to put them all into a spreadsheet. And then I took those and put them in, like a little, like I used Adobe InDesign to create the templates, and then they're now all saved as like PDF documents for all of the cards. So it's like front card, back card, all the way through for the like 12 card sets that are in the game.
Yeah, it's a fairly component heavy game.
It definitely looks like a lot of cards. Yeah.
And is it true that the game was actually run in a museum?
It is.
Could you tell us a little bit about how that came about?
Yeah, okay. So I volunteer at the Hellenic Museum, which is just in the Melbourne CBD. It's quite a little museum, but it covers a lot of Greek history and some contemporary Greek art. So I've been volunteering there since I was in uni. And we did a deal with them to basically get their event space to run the game in exchange for me helping them get a Greek mythology themed D&D event off the ground that they've been working on for a while. So they were super gracious to us in letting us use their event space, and very, very accommodating for, so, you know, Mega Games are a long game and They were really supportive of that, provide us with a lot of, furniture, equipment, TV, all of that.
And also very accommodating on the day. Just big a shout out to Ben and Sarah from the Hellenic Museum who helped us run the event on the day.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was just a really nice kind of a communitarian exchange. I really, really appreciated the fact that Sarah, the CEO, who is not the aforementioned Sarah, who is the museum assistant curator. Sarah, the CEO, basically was really, really happy for me to value add to the museum by working on Gods and Greeks in exchange for us getting to run our event. And that was, you don't see that very often, I think, in event spaces. So I was really appreciative of that.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. I think that's definitely the best way you can do venues for a mega game if you can manage it, is that kind of exchange.
Yeah. And you were talking before about how at the first event you kind of had a lot of the mega game regulars who've come to your previous events. Did you find that the second event and the demand for it was sort of linked to the fact that you had this venue and a bit of additional sort of exposure and branding?
I'm actually not sure that the draw was so much based on the museum. I think that was a nice bonus for the Mega Game players. We also, the actual event space is behind the museum. So you kind of come through and then go out the back. And because we made the decision to not include a lunch break, there wasn't actually a huge amount of time for players to go and explore the museum. I'm hoping that they'll just go back in their own time if they were interested.
Yeah.
But yeah, it wasn't, I think the draw was more that it was a mega game and it's the first mega game coming out of the pandemic that globally, people were really excited about.
Yeah.
I've been really hesitant to like post on social media and the groups about it because I don't want to make everyone who is still stuck in a lockdown feel really bad about the fact that they can't go to a mega game. But at the same time, I'm like, it went so well and I'm so excited about it. I just want to talk about it.
Yeah.
So,
post on social media so they can live vicariously through our mega game.
It's true. And I could probably just tag at the start, don't read this if you're feeling really disappointed about not going to a mega game.
I think they would love it, to be honest. I think they'd love it.
Actually, another change we made this game is we had a dedicated photographer for both games.
Oh, lovely. So you have a lot of good
control team. Oh, I haven't seen them yet. I'm very excited too when they come out. Have you seen them yet, Nelly? Yeah.
I have not. I will get them from Tatiana sometime in the next week. That was actually, despite the fact that it was a really control heavy game, we ended up with the second game had 15 control players. Running it. We actually ended up with a really big team, and that meant that we could add a couple of extra roles like the photographer. We also added a role this game called New Player Control, which we kind of decided to make the all-rounder below game control. So someone who's not responsible for managing the overall narrative, but who can still go around and check on players who look a little bit lost and confused and redirect them to the other control players who can actually answer their questions. And that worked really well for the first game. For the second game, we had an issue with a team not showing up. And that's how Tristan ended up playing. So Tristan and Tessa, who was meant to be our new player control for game two, ended up playing as the British Museum, which was fine, but it was not what we'd planned for, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
right. Makes sense.
And it was interesting having to step into this. I think I'll talk about it a bit more in Spoiler Town. But I'd sort of redesigned a bit of the game. I knew the plots. I'd done game control for game one. I knew all the spoilers and the story threads throughout the game. And so there was a particular challenge playing the second game, having to sort of not meta game in that way.
Right. That does sound tough. Awesome. Okay, I think last question before we go to Spoiler Town. What was your before the first game started, what was your biggest worry about the game or, you know, something that you were not sure about?
Mine's pretty general. Oh, man. It was running a mega game after 2020.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
So we had this great momentum coming out of 2019. We just run For the Crown. We were really feeling kick-ass about it. And, you know, we had those plans, grand plans for 2020. And then, obviously, it happened. And we put all this work into It Belongs in a Museum. We got a week out from running the game, I think, and then lockdown happened. And that just threw us for an absolute tailspin. And so coming out of that to actually sit and run a game and get through it properly and get through the stress of the week before, I'm sure as you both know as designers, the week before running a game is pleasant experience.
It's a special time.
Isn't it just a special time? I think I made the comment to my partner that I should take a day off work or something just to really, really get ready for it. But actually having, you know, that was my biggest stress was could we run the game? Could we get it together and would people show up and would people have fun?
Yeah. I think I agree with that. Mine is also a little bit more personal in that because I come from more of a design background, and I've really only gotten into board games and tabletop RPGs and gaming more generally since I got to university, that stepping into the role of game control, which is this is the first time that I'd done game control, I was quite, like, I just second-guessing myself about whether I knew the rules. And then I was really happy with how I did in the end.
Brilliant job.
By the time we got to the game, I'd had the rules for over a year and I knew what was going on. I agree with Tristan, but yeah, that was my biggest concern was I was like, can I personally actually do this and keep on top of everything? I could. That was nice. That and the other thing was that because we had put so much effort into the components that I was really worried that people were going to damage them and lose them. I don't think we lost anything in game one in the end. We might have lost a single dice.
Yeah, I think one die.
Or two.
Awesome. Yeah.
But we got all the cards back. I don't think we did so well in game two. I think we're still missing some cards.
Yes, I still need to do a proper stock take out of that. But yeah, I think a couple of cards, a couple of dice, a couple of tokens, but... That's
all right. A few
casualties. It's the casualties of war.
Yeah. If we run it again, we would be able to budget to replace those. So I'm not super concerned, even if I am a little disappointed because we did ask for players to be really gentle and really careful.
Even as control, I think I've ended games and then found things in my pockets a week later.
No.
It's very like that. One thing I guess I haven't spoken about in this game, we kind of touched on it earlier, but parts of the game are actually there's mini games. So there's research mini games, which Theo spoke about a little bit, which are like mental games, mental puzzles. And we're very deeply indebted to one of our control team that was the research control for the first game, Matthew Schaffner, who actually came up with the entire research game for us. So they're like little mental trivia games and, you know, word quizzes and find things and mastermind puzzles. And that's, people had so much fun playing that part of the game. We got tons of great things to say about that.
Awesome.
But then also there's dexterity-based games. So like little mini games, whether it be Jenga or stacking cups or like Simon Says. They're little puzzles meant to mimic Indiana Jones stealing the golden idol off the weight at the end, you know, replacing it with a bag of sand. And so... Yeah, I think we had a lot of fun collecting and finding those in the lead up to the game and then actually using them on the day.
Mm.
Nice. That's something I definitely want to hear more about. Theo, just to clarify, did you play in both of these games or did you run one of them?
No, I played in game one and I ran in game two. So I am very grateful that for all that I played as Cairo Museum, which is sort of it is the team that has the most spoiler information, but it's also it was really nice to go into this without having spoilers. Whereas my stresses were all my teammate dropped out a week before the game, so I was frantically trying to find a new teammate and assembling props to sow some extra chaos at the people I'm normally game controlling with.
Yep. Yeah, dropouts in this game were a bit of a struggle. I will say game two was particularly bad because we got to the sign in time and we had half of one museum team, another museum team, and then there were two whole teams missing.
Yeah, it sounds really pivotal as well with the way that this game's designed. Just so that we have our obligatory Watch the Skies reference, for example, there's been runs of that, and you know, if a nation doesn't show up, it's not a big deal. There's nine others, but this sounds like the design is quite compact.
Yeah.
Everyone's quite pivotal to making things move.
Exactly.
That would have been a struggle.
Yeah.
I think
we'd be okay if we were missing an explorer team that wasn't one of like three of the key ones, but missing a museum changes everything.
Right.
One of our control for game one very reasonably asked me like 3 days before the game, what's your plan if a team doesn't show up? And I was like, no, I think they'll all come. And literally a day later, one of the museum teams in game one emailed and they were like, I'm so sorry, we have to pull out. And that this was the day before the game. Tristan and I are like frantically posting in all the Facebook groups and all the Discord servers, messaging all the people we know, being like, hey, do you want to come play a mega game, please? And very luckily we found a team. We're super grateful to them as well. But yeah, I didn't really have a plan, I think, for what was going to happen if a museum team didn't show up. Because as Theo says, it would have been fine to run it without an explorer team. I think we kind of had the thought as well that we could just co-opt an explorer team to be a three-person museum team and just shift their role. But yeah, it is one of those games where museums in particular are the movers and shakers, and without them, the balance really tips over.
Yeah. Well, on that note, we might go to the appropriately branded spoiler town and start delving into some of the details of the games a little bit. So for anyone listening along, if you're interested in playing It Belongs in a Museum, or you're interested in, I guess that's it really. If you don't want spoilers about the details of how lots of the nitty gritty works, this is probably the best time to jump out. But otherwise, we'll go head first into it. And I guess the best place to start is just with your first game. You guys, you've run it twice. How did the first game go? And how did walk us through how each part of the game went, like those mini games?
So it went really, really well. We're really, really happy. So there's a bunch of hidden different plots throughout the game. And like I said, each character has a briefing and each team has a briefing. In the first game, basically, there are a few teams that were very clearly oriented towards a specific goal. And that's something we changed quite something for the second game, which gave every team a really specific goal. But in the first game, there's only a few teams that had that. But I was really pleased to say that all of them achieved that goal, basically. Without going into too much depth, I think the most interesting team in the game is actually the Cairo Museum. And I'd like to ask Theo to talk a little bit about what his experience playing the first game was like.
So, for context, so the Cairo Museum are definitely not a front for the Cult of Apophis. Definitely not. So they're very much sort of we're bringing about the end of the world to sort of, you know, punish the colonial powers for pillaging our great treasures.
Nice.
So game one, they're basically spending all of their time and resources trying to follow this one overarching plot for the end of the game to summon, you know, the Egyptian god of chaos and destruction.
Awesome.
And so basically we spent the whole game going after our quests and looking for relics that we then sold to the Axis government to fund our cult. So we had the great fun of kicking off World War II fairly early with the Trojan horse crossing the Maginot Line, opening up the gates of hell, and demons shooting Archimedes' death rays at the French defenders.
I should clarify, this game is set in the 19th century, so the shadow of the war is a looming threat across the game. That's a key thread. So the four museums, it's key to point out, are the British Museum of Natural History, the Smithsonian Museum, the Cairo Museum, and the Bavarian Museum. So you've kind of got an access for your allies, sort of, you know, dichotomy there, which is an interesting tension as well.
And I had also had the fun of sort of my individual briefing said that, you know, my teammate, you know, had this information of she had some allies to help her in this cult. I did not know that actually none of the allies knew that they were part of the Cult of Apophis. And so I had set up my own mechanic of, well, I'm going to start my own cults and, you know, handed out envelopes with little tokens and messages to various players saying you are now part of, you know, a cult of the Norse gods or the Knights Hospitaller. And Control just thought that was me playing into that. But no, this was me doing my own thing, not knowing that that was part of the game.
I also kept seeing tokens and just being like, oh, that team has coordinated some, like, finely tuned costumes. I'm very impressed. And it wasn't till the end of the game where you revealed what you'd done that I was like, wait, that was you? So you pulled that off really well. I thought that was great.
I think it's also sort of Cairo Museum are the chaos team. And so as someone who's normally control that, and this is the first time I've got to play since God Emperor, sort of I was very much, let's throw some chaos at the people I'm normally controlling with.
The thing is, it didn't cause any upset. Like, you managed to something that was really fun and engaging for the players. It was a little bit extra, and it didn't actually interfere with the running of the game at all. So I really appreciated that aspect as well. Yeah.
It was good chaos.
Yeah, exactly.
The best kind. And I think we had some really interesting... So one other mechanic that's in the game is research papers. Players can write and publish research papers. And so there was a beautiful collection of those that came out through the first game with interesting findings from all sorts of different corners of the world. But we also had some other interesting plots that fired off. So the Cult of Apophis and Theo managed to achieve their goal later in the game. But at the same time, other groups have different plots. So one group is called the Polar Explorers. They're actually well known as the Arctic Crazies because they're obsessed with going to the Arctic Circle and exploring there. And they definitely have no association with the Thing. Because they definitely didn't run into a bunch of basically doppelganger aliens. And it actually turns out that one of the characters, this is heavy spoilers, is actually already a doppelganger, finds his dead body, and then midway through the game pivots entirely his motivation to become about spreading basically this doppelganger virus throughout the entire game. And does that by giving basically everyone a black dot that they put on their lanyards. So everyone had lanyards with their names, their character's name, their name, their pronouns, their stats on it. And part of that was they would spread this doppelganger virus around, will you? And this player, the player that was the doppelganger, managed to actually spread it to Control as well, which I thought was quite impressive, given that Control knew it was coming.
And was this little subplot with the Thing? I mean, these kind of team subplots, were these all written into the game, or are these things that you designed?
So
those ones were written into the game.
Yeah,
I think the Thing and the Apophis are all embedded in the rules.
Definitely sounds like the twist of the UK mega game scene from what we've heard over the years.
Exactly. But in that vein, when we added the eighth and then the ninth team, we actually added our own version of that, our own plot. And that's very strongly to do with the Matthew Riley books. In that, the objective in the first one of those books is to go after the golden pyramid, the golden capstone of the pyramid at Giza. And so we literally took that and embedded that wholesale in the game. We had to design out essentially a quest for the golden capstone, a quest for something else to do with that, and then a quest for them to use that in its, basically there's a ritual they can use to activate it and get its power. And so we end up designing those parts of it. And that also had to be written into briefings and explained through motivations and how those characters relate to one another. And then we also had to tie that into the wider game. So, you know, what does that mean once you've done that, once you've achieved this ritual with the golden capstone, what's it actually do? And so in the first game, that was a bit wishy-washy, but in the second game, we iterated and improved upon that and tied it directly into the way that the Apophis mechanics and summoning God of Destruction worked, in that if you did the golden capstone thing, you could actually set back that team that was trying to summon Apophis by a few steps. Yeah. So the idea is that a lot of the plots and intricacies were all linked to one another throughout the game. As is the best kind of chaos in a mini game, everything's linked together.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah. It sounds like there was a lot of very tightly interwoven pre-written material. Is that right?
Correct. So this is possibly the most content-heavy mega game I've seen or touched. I reckon there's at least 20,000 words within not just the rule book, but the player briefings, the team briefings, the control rule book, the expeditions. So there's 90 expeditions, all of which probably have a paragraph on each of their five steps. So you're looking at something within the realm of 450 individual paragraphs of content. That's narrative content. And then add to that, the dice checks around it, things like that. It's so much content in this game. And that really comes out throughout the entire game. And a lot of that is pre-written. So a lot of that was, a lot of the work that we did before the game was actually compiling that into a manageable format. So it now all exists in really nice, easy to use spreadsheets that list all the content indistinctly. And it's something I'm really proud of to actually hand back to the wider mega gaming community and Jake and Rick in the UK.
Awesome. So it sounds like a ton of work in the front end. Yeah, how did you find all that stuff playing out in the day? It sounds like it went awesome.
Theo, did you have fun?
I had a lot of fun. I did kind of feel like the last turn, very much sort of with all this organized chaos coming together, you very much hit a point where, depending on how many of the subplots have come to a head, control basically needs to just sort of step in and narrate.
Mm.
And I wasn't a fan of that needing to happen, mm-hmm. but then coming in as control in the second game, it's like, oh, yes, there's so much going on that basically that's the only way this can get resolved.
Which I don't think is uncommon across Mega games. You know, I've seen last turns in for the Crown and last turns in other games where, you know, game controls basically sat down and said, this is the outcome of the game. This is what happened with all of your little plots that you were trying to put together.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember getting some specific feedback, I think, in our game Brave New World. And you kind of can't win because we would do that. There were all these. It was a very narrative light game. Everyone was, you know, it's a geopolitical game where everyone's creating their own plots. And at the end, we just did a bit of a monologue to say this is what happened next, and all these little plots that people had invented. And you know, some people didn't enjoy that because it didn't go the way that they thought. And then I've had other experiences where I've decided not to wrap it up and give an ending, and the feedback's been, well, where was the ending? We didn't get any ending. So it's difficult when you've got so much narrative and so many different players happening to really satisfy everyone. But I can imagine this game sounds very story heavy. So a narrative wrap-up was probably pretty important.
We ran into that a bit in Watch the Skies. So when we ran Watch the Skies, it ended with a Dyson sphere closing around the Earth. But that was all player-driven, and it was like what this team have managed to pull this off sort of stuff. So for all that it was control narrating to everyone else, it was we're now announcing to you all what these other teams have been doing.
Mm.
Yeah, I think some of the player discomfort as well comes from being completely blindsided. Mm. So if you have just been in your little corner of the game, operating on your things, only interacting with certain elements, and you turn around at the end of the game, Apophis has been released and the world is ending. That can be, I think, really, confronting as you're like, I did not see this coming. I had no concept that this was a possibility. Yeah. I have to figure out how to work through this now. And I think a lot of the feedback that we got from players was that they were like, we had no idea that this was even a possibility, and we had only one round really to prepare to resolve it. I've kind of gone back and forth on how much sympathy I have for that. Because I, you know, part of me thinks that it would be better to have team briefings or player briefings that specifically flag that if you have individual like player goals that are quite, you know, complex and specific, then other teams probably do as well. And it would be worth maybe trying to find out what those are and that kind of thing. But then also I think particularly in game two, I was so tired by the time we got to round eight or whenever it was we wrapped up that I don't think we did the best job that we could have done of narrating the ending.
Right, that's right.
So there's also, this.
I found the ending of game two much better because so the person who was doppelganging managed to get everyone the sticker. And so just that reveal at the end was so much better just because it was like, oh, they've actually, the player has managed to drive this to its conclusion all the way through.
Yeah,
that was super impressive. But again, other players were quite upset at that. They really didn't understand what that was or why Control thought that was hilarious and a really positive outcome.
To be fair, I had a lot of players come up to me as Espionage Control looking into it.
Yeah, people spent research on that as well.
And to be fair, I wasn't expecting it to be an endgame plot, so I was giving them sort of silly answers.
Right. It's always hard with any kind of secrets to get everyone being satisfied at the end because it's really hard with so many people to avoid them feeling left out or blindsided. Or feeling
like it came out of nowhere because their characters didn't manage to get any information on the secret. Yeah.
And then the obvious link, like the obvious jump there is, well, that kind of devalues some of the stuff I did. It's always, yeah, it's always really tricky to keep everyone comfortable without giving up the grand secret.
Yeah.
And so a big balm that we put towards that was in the second game, every team more explicitly had an objective. So in the first game, they didn't necessarily have that. But in the second game, yeah, every team really explicitly had, this is kind of the thing you're going for. We modified some of the original teams to do that. And that, I think, worked better because everyone sort of had a thing they were working towards. They felt like they could at least achieve that. But at the same time, some of the, I mean, this is a conflict, I think Nelly kind of got it earlier, but it's a conflict I've been feeling quite a lot with this game. It's very different to other games where the narrative and the fun stories that come out that you're sharing in the pub afterwards are actually driven not so much by player-driven, created narrative, but by the way players interacted with the things that the narrative and the game presents to them. And by that, I mean, you go on these plots and it's the way you solve problems, or it's the way that you... For example, in the second game, one character got a boon, which is basically the opposite of a curse, if you will, a boon that lets them turn into an eagle. And this character just became an eagle and kept using the shapeshift into eagle at random places, whether it be... And this is a character that was in debt, so they basically went to game control and was like, I would like to shapeshift into an eagle and go and shoot the man in the leg that owes me, that I owe the money to. That's how they solved their debt crisis.
That was great.
Modern problems.
Well, my favorite example was sort of the team going into the castle, and it's like, you're going into the castle. You can't take your tank into the castle. It's like, we drive our tank through the castle wall.
Okay. Amazing. I missed that.
Yeah, that was
I will say, I think the other balm to dealing with players feeling blindsided and upset at having the end game be narrated by control is just get them to come to the pub and sit down afterwards and chat and let them talk to other players and find out what was going on in other sections of the game. I think that element to me has become much more important through the course of these two games. It soothes a lot of discomfort. I did not see this coming. What is happening? How do I deal with it?
That makes sense.
But in the best way, we had a lot of players that couldn't do that this game. And that was because the second game in particular, we had a lot of new players to the game and new different age group players as well. So we were really, really fortunate, really lucky to have a bunch of older players, parents and teachers and kind of people that were interested in the game came along. And it was really, really great to see a more diverse group of people playing these games. That was really, really heartening to see. And we got really different experiences across both games.
We had a father-son team in game one playing the Bavarian Museum. And that is possibly one of my favorite things that I've seen in an Omega game. They had so much fun together.
That's lovely.
And that's my recommendation. I'm just like, bring your parents.
That's awesome.
So we were talking about feedback there. How did you guys collect feedback? And, you know, apart from the stuff we've talked about, were there any highlights or lowlights from that feedback you got?
I put together a more comprehensive feedback form this time. So we gathered the same demographic data that we usually gather. So we ask about age group, whether you're a university student, what your gender identity is, whether you've played in a mega game before, whether you've played in one of our games before, whether you'd like to come back and play in our games. All of that comes out pretty cleanly. And I think we have so far 100% success rate for people filling out the feedback form and saying, yeah, I want to come back for a new game for the next game that you run. Then I made a little table that was basically ranking on a 5-point scale a bunch of different elements. So it was like, I think I put it on the like well below expectations all the way to way above expectations. Because I find that a better way of assessing, I think it's, you know, qualitative assessments are really hard to judge. You know, people have different opinions of what is good, what is reasonable. And so judging it based on expectations, I thought was a easier way of seeing whether we were lining up with what people wanted. And then we had some freeform questions at the end that were, we had one question that was specific to the game mechanics, one question that was specific to the narrative and the plot of the game, and one question that was like just general feedback, anything else you want to tell us. And I think I also put in the narrative question that was where I wanted them to tell us all of their funny stories. And that was really good. And I also made an effort to communicate to players that we really wanted their feedback, but the best thing that they could do was to tell us what their problem was and how they thought we should fix it rather than just telling us what their problem was. And tried to remind them that at the end of the day, there are human beings on the other side of the feedback form who have to read their feedback, and so to be gentle with us. And they all took that on board, and I really appreciate it, because I remember reading feedback from Watch the Skies that was quite harsh, and being like, oh, we put all this effort in, and just sounds like you had a really bad time, and now I feel really bad.
Yeah, it's always tricky to balance, and it's also I find it's also really easy to give negative feedback opposed to positive. So it sounds like you got some really good positive stuff, and definitely asking people how to change their ratings on things is always a good thing. I've got great feedback from people on design stuff or narrative things in the past.
Yeah,
I was really interested. Just because personally, some feedback I've received on it myself, how did people receive what I think you were mentioning earlier, Tristan, some of the dexterity games and problem-solving games that were there to represent going on the expeditions?
That's, a really good question. So dexterity games were very much a case of, what they were, so people are clear, is we went to basically op shops and found all the cheap children's games you could think of, whether it be something like Jenga or there were fast stacking cups, or like putting Lego together in a speedy way. You know, one of the games we found that was probably the most fun people had was someone put on a little like cap, and that cap had like Velcro on it. You had to throw balls that stuck, like little felt balls that stuck to the Velcro. And a lot of those had to be balanced on the day, right? Because we didn't have a list of games we were predefined trying to get out, and there was no sort of predefined metrics. You know, success on this game is measured by this. It was basically control would say, okay, I need you, when you're picking up sticks, I need you to pick up 6 sticks for me to get this thing, but pulling it out of a tomb. And I think people had a lot of fun with those when they were managed well by control. A strong piece of feedback we got across all of sort of control for this game, and this is really hard when you've got a big control team with diverse thoughts and diverse ideas, especially when they're empowered to be sort of game masters in this way, was actually consistency of rules implementation. And that was something we struggled with across both games, I think. I don't think it was a problem. I think the feedback we got was players found it challenging to engage with sometimes, but not in a way that made them step out of the game or made them unhappy. What did you think?
Right.
Yeah, so I agree with that. I think there were some bits of it where interpretation of the rules in particular ways was actually important that we make sure was consistent. And so that was a change that we tried to make between the two games. But I think some of the more fluid and nuanced ways that differentiate how people, you know, DM or run games, I don't give much time to people struggling with those differences between control, because all of our control, I trust all of our control team. I really value the differences that they bring to the game. And we encouraged control to circulate and to play with different explorer teams all through the game. So they should have got a diversity of experiences. So I have mixed views on that. I think it's, consistency of rules is important, but I also think variety in experiences is a worthwhile aspect of the game.
Yeah, absolutely. And that played back into how they interacted with those, you know, dexterity mini games. And it meant that people had more tailored experiences as well. You know, if a team was clearly struggling with a dexterity mini game, I think control all the time, we have a really good team of control. They were very good at identifying that and working to that and, you know, changing the rules if they needed to, to make sure that people had fun, because that's what's most important, really.
Awesome.
Yeah. So the reason I asked that was just because I've had very specific feedback in previous games that was so polarizing about some of those things. And I was trying to, you know, I guess it's a personal preference, but some people really didn't like the idea that these fun little side things were meant to represent something else. I think they were looking for things that were more literal, but I'm really interested in how those kind of mini games can be used in mega games. They're perfect for those kind of like skill challenges where you usually just brush over them with a dice roll.
Definitely.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah. I think.
Oh, you go, Nelly.
Oh no, I was just going to say that I think my biggest takeaway from this game is that the best way to prevent players from having a negative experience on the day is to communicate and set their expectations properly. And so one of the things that we brought out before this game was a little set of like cheat sheets about all of our games that just kind of lists some basic information about what they are, and then hopefully when we pitch the game to our community, we give them a bit more information about it, and they come in knowing what to expect. And so if there are mini games involved, they see it coming and they can choose not to attend if that's something that they really struggle with, or at least be prepared to deal with it, or maybe pick a character role that doesn't involve dealing with it, that kind of thing. I think that's, to me, has been something that's come out as really the best way to deal with preemptively dealing with that kind of feedback.
Yeah. And I think, Tristan, what really, you say? Well, I think an interesting perspective I got playing the second game was that it was really disheartening to muck up these mini games, right? When I got them wrong, and I failed two of these dexterity mini games. We didn't get the item at the end of the quest because of that, because I personally, you know, didn't throw the ball onto someone's head, or because I personally couldn't stack cards into a pyramid. And that sucked. That was a really hollow feeling. But it actually made, when we did succeed, all that sweeter, and it made the other experiences I had all that sweeter. So, like, there are positives and negatives to it. I think next time I would encourage control a little more, and maybe this is something that I didn't do this time. I would encourage control a little more to be more, okay, let's make sure that people are succeeding, failing upwards in a way of some sort.
Yeah,
that makes sense. Awesome. Yeah. Well, I think we're running to the end of our time here. I think the last question I'd like to ask is, what's next for Melbourne Mega Games?
We are a friend of ours. Actually, my partner is writing a mega game called The Ark. It is a science fiction game where the last surviving dredges of humanity have boarded a ship called The Ark, and they are out in space trying to survive. So we have playtested that game once. We will be doing another playtest probably in June, and that hopefully will be the next game that we run. And I'm very excited for it. I'm really excited to have a game come out of our community. That means a lot to us. I take that as quite a strong measure of success. Mm-hmm. That someone's come to our games, had such a good time, and then sat down and had the time, the energy, the creativity to put something on paper and bring it back to us. That I'm, phenomenally excited about that. And I think it's going to be a really good game.
It's going to be really exciting. And there's always ideas permeating and percolating beneath the surface as well. We've got a couple of other people that have suggested games. I know Theo's got something that's mulling in his head. I've got that's mulling in my head.
Struggling to get it on the paper.
The eternal challenge, as I'm sure Pat and Jack can relate
I think something else that we're looking at doing through this year is potentially trying to run some kind of workshop or writer's room kind of sessions where you bring your game pitch and, everyone sits down and kind of bounces ideas off each other and tries to develop something into maybe a fully fleshed out pitch or a rule set or something, like whatever stage you want to bring your game up to. I haven't really formalized that idea yet. It's just something I've been toying with. But,
awesome.
Yeah, now that we've got a few more ideas.
That'd be really cool. I think that's something that the UK crowd has always had for a long time, and something that we're lacking here.
Yeah,
definitely.
The design community formalized. So that'd be awesome. Definitely keep us in the loop on that.
Well, my one other final note is that we would like to bring IBAM up to Sydney and Brisbane at some point as well. Now that we've run it twice and we have all of these beautiful materials for it, that would be the other thing.
Yeah, I would love to have it
up
in Brisbane. It sounds like an awesome game.
Yeah, we will definitely.
Then the question is whether you two can find a museum to run it in.
yeah, guys. Awesome.
Well, thank you all for joining us. The three of you, it sounds like you put on and played in awesome, awesome games. Really keen to see more of IBAM and also more from Melbourne Mega Games. Where can people find more information about you and your games?
Okay, so we are primarily on Facebook, but we are starting to transition away from that. We have in the wrap-up of IBAM, we have set up, we're on Instagram and Twitter now. There is nothing on those accounts yet, but we will start posting shortly. And we've also set up our Discord now, so that I think is where we're going to try and center our community and create a kind of hub for discussion about, games and their aftermath, but also like potential design. So, Facebook is currently the best place to go to find our information. You can join our mailing list. We're at melbourne.megagames@gmail.com. And we will communicate all of the information about where else to find us, probably through Facebook for the moment. Did I miss anything, T?
No, that's it. That's cool. The tweet.
That's send us. Tweet.
Yep. Awesome. Any final words, Theo?
Thanks for having us. I've listened to a bunch of your episodes before and keep up the good work of spreading the Mega Game news.
Oh, thank you. Thanks to all of you for joining. It was absolutely fantastic. And can't wait to see more.